Welcome, everybody. I wish I had a bell to ring.
Whistle.
Hey, that worked. I love it. So I'm so glad you're here. The Grolier Club is the oldest bibliophilic society in America, started in 1884. I bet you can't say that. I've been practicing. So it's a place we wouldn't know about, but I consider it the oldest book club in America. So you could think of it like that. A lot of people who like to read books got together. And if you could tell me who those two busts are up there, you can have an extra cookie.
They're not mine. That's correct.
Okay, thank you for that. We had a vote for Washington and a vote for Shakespeare, but I don't know. So we're really glad that you came today. How many of you got to go outside? Who are the brave people? Almost everybody. Good for you. Well, it's really pretty and charming in all the rooms here. I'm going to start today by asking you who you came here to think about and to remember. Somebody you lost, or just interested in estate planning, or anybody want to volunteer? Jay, you like to speak up.
I came because the spouse asked me to.
Okay. We'll go with that. Anybody else? Yes.
I came because my nephew just recently lost his wife.
I'm sorry, yes. That's too bad. And big shock. Yeah. Anybody else want to contribute? Yes.
We lost a dear friend a couple of years ago, and you know, I saw what his wife is going through as a survivor, you know, and the sort of the mad scramble of trying to figure out the finances that details probably weren't really shared with her to a great degree. And so this is like, you know, looking ahead for my husband, Stephen, and I, just
yes,
to be able to tell our kids sort of what to expect and get them informed.
Great, informed. Okay, so our firm works closely with family members who've lost a loved one, and we can help you not only with planning questions you may have had about redoing your will or something like that, but also I think we could contribute some ideas that you haven't thought about. So, you know, whenever you're ready, almost everybody here's a client, so just pick up the phone and don't feel you're imposing on us. We'd love to answer your questions, so anytime. In your folder, you have a checklist of things to consider when you're recently bereaved. You can read that later at home. You also have an article that I wrote about what to do in times of change, and so you can look that over another time. And in addition, you have three worksheets that we're going to be going over with you today so that you could put in your own thoughts, or maybe it'll generate some thinking on your part, and we're going to help you go over that. And it's not a test. There's no right or wrong. We're not going to be asking to see what you've written. It's just for you. So at Altfest, I'm proud to say we have a wonderful group of very smart and very caring professionals. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to two of those professionals today. Keith Feinberg is a financial advisor at Altfest, and he's also an estate attorney. And he'll share his thinking on what you can do regarding your estate planning after the loss of a loved one. Keith earned his JD from St. John's University and an honors BA from the University of Delaware, and holds the CFP designation as well. And he has a new puppy named Archie. And I've seen pictures. Don't ask him. Don't get him started. He's a proud puppy papa.
That's true.
And Allison Roth works in financial planning at Altfest. Allison is a CFA, a chartered financial analyst. That's a very important investment designation. And she's a financial planning specialist at the firm. She's currently studying for the CFP exam, which she's going to take soon. And she has a BBA from Loyola Marymount University in L.A. in finance and economics, which is pretty hefty stuff. Allison enjoys watching and playing sports. And I've heard that she's a bit of a foodie. Is that right? And she has a little kitten named Captain.
Any cat people in the room?
Keith?
figured we have one dog person, one cat person.
Right? Yeah, we had to keep it even. I'm really glad to be here to talk about my puppy for the next half hour.
Well, you have to prepare for the eventuality that the puppy's left alone.
It's good you say that, because I've already had the conversation with my wife that she's getting none of my money and the puppy's getting all of it. So I'm glad we can have that discussion up front here. She's not here, so I can say that. Nobody tell me. Thank you.
What kind of a dog?
It's a toy poodle. I'll be happy to share pictures with you. I have a whole album on my phone. None of my wedding, but all of my dog. I wish that was a joke. But.
Is she brown or black?
He's apricot.
Oh, that's the same as my nephew. He has the same dog.
It's a great dog. He's very, very smart. In fact, he wrote most of my presentation today. I'm just kidding. I wrote it. Now I'm definitely really off course. I don't know where I'm going with this, but... I was going to start actually with a story about my own family, about my grandfather. You know, when my grandmother passed away, my grandfather had to essentially learn how to take care of a house, cook for himself, clean for himself, do all those things. And, you know, he had never done it before, but the one thing that he didn't have to do was take care of the finances or the estate planning. It was a really great lesson for me as somebody who was just in law school at the time that planning is really the most important thing you can do. And luckily for my grandfather, he had a brilliant grandson and a brilliant granddaughter and me. We were very proactive. We took care of planning long before my grandmother passed away. So really for him, all he had to do was kind of just learn how to, you know, cook. And that first year we tried to make a brisket together for the Jewish holidays. And apparently you're supposed to use Lipton soup mix, but we use Lipton tea bags. It was probably the worst dinner we ever had. So don't do that. If you'd like the recipe, I don't have it clearly. The first thing I really wanted to talk about was, you know, after the loss of a loved one, whether it's a spouse or a sibling or an uncle or an aunt or anybody, what you should really be considering is, what does my estate plan look like now, and is it still appropriate? For a lot of people, they plan with their spouse or they plan with a sibling in mind if they don't have children. And if that person's passed away, it can create a lot of problems when it comes to probating a will or passing through a trust. So for us, it's appropriate to have a conversation and say, does this still make sense? Have my goals changed? We like to ask people, you know, now that you have the opportunity to review it, what would you change? And then they come to us and say, what should I change? And it's really, really important that you kind of take the opportunity now that whether you've lost a spouse and you're on your own as a unit, or you've lost another family member, that you look back and say, when I made this estate plan, what was the goal? What were my intentions? And are those intentions still appropriate? We recently had a client who came to us and he asked me to review his estate plan. And I looked at it and I said, who is this primary beneficiary? And he said, oh, that's my brother. He lives in France. And I said, how old is he? He said, well, he's 97. I said, oh, that's incredible. And he said, well, it would be, but he passed away 15 years ago. Now we got a problem because he hasn't reviewed his estate plan since. Mm-hmm. So luckily, he's taking some advice and he's going to take care of that now. But his brother wasn't there. His sister wasn't there. He hadn't contemplated having any children. Basically, his estate plan was going to be a mess. And not only was it going to be a mess for passing things through, but a lot of the money would have ended up out of the country. And that would have been subject to a lot of different taxation that personally I didn't want to sift through. And I know he didn't either. So he was very happy that we went back and did that. One thing that I can tell you, and I know it's an uncomfortable conversation, and we're more than happy to have it for you, actually. I'm just kidding. But you come to our office, bring your family, have a discussion with your beneficiaries, whether they're now beneficiaries because somebody's passed away or it's always been your intended plan to distribute money to these people. Have the conversation early and have it multiple times. You don't want to get into a situation where a child wanted a rug or a painting or a guitar and they didn't get it, and they're resentful or they have some sort of animosity. It's easy enough to have a conversation and explain why. Or at the very least, perhaps you paid for one of your children's medical school. We've seen that. And then you don't want to leave the same thing to the other. You know, you want to leave more to the other child. You want to make it even of some sorts. Have that conversation early. It's easy enough, you know, to say, I paid $500,000 for you to go to med school. This is why you're getting $500,000 less. Right? I mean, it's an easy enough conversation to give an explanation. I realize how uncomfortable that might be, but it's going to save you in the long run. You don't want to have siblings with animosity for no reason. The second thing I want to talk about is updating your beneficiaries. If you've had an annual meeting with AltFest, you know that we're big on checking your IRA beneficiaries. We'll pretty much bother you every year about it, whether anything's changed or not. And we're going to continue to do that. So just be prepared. I don't see any of my clients, so I haven't bothered anybody here yet. But if you want me to, I'm happy to do that. So what we would want you to do is take a look at those beneficiaries and decide whether that's still the appropriate option for your retirement accounts or your life insurance or annuities or anything that you might have that passes through a beneficiary designation. Oftentimes, people get a job at 25, 30 years old. They get a retirement plan through their company. And 40 years later, it's still their parents as the beneficiary. It's not really a great thing. Causes a lot of work for everybody. And a lot of times, the parents are no longer in the picture. Similarly, we have people who get that first job and they have a spouse as the beneficiary and they have one child as the contingent beneficiary. They never bother to update it, and three children later, and guess who's not getting an inheritance? Mm-hmm. The second three, right? So it's really important for when we bother you about those beneficiary designations, take the time to think about it. We're not doing it for fun. I promise you, we really don't enjoy printing out those forms every year and sending you home with them. Just send them back. Take a look. Have a conversation. And then, again, this is an important time to have a conversation with your beneficiaries. Explain, doesn't have to be numbers. You don't have to tell them what you have, but having a conversation about how the assets are titled. I have retirement accounts. I have life insurance. I have an annuity. This is how things are going to come to you. I don't want you to be upset when they come this way. I don't want you to be angry with me or resentful that it's locked in an inherited IRA, something like that. So just being thoughtful and considerate about having the conversation is the most important thing you can do. In my previous life, I come from a family office space, very large, complicated family estates. And I can't tell you how many times that a conversation just over dinner would have saved years and years of resentment. I've seen situations where there's siblings who are beneficiaries of the same trust and haven't been in the same room in 45 years. Kind of a difficult situation. Especially awkward at family dinners when they have to sit on either side of the table. It's really the most important thing you can do is to just sit down, be thoughtful, be considerate, and have a discussion. If you don't want to leave something to somebody for a specific reason, it's better to tell them why and not have them be guessing after you're gone. These are all things that we can do to take care of things up front. And Karen always says, our conference rooms are open if you want to have those conversations with us. You know, we do a pretty good job of explaining things, and we're happy to have that conversation, you know, with you and your family. Everybody here has built a certain amount of wealth, and most people intend to pass that on to their descendants and their children and take care of their families. So if those are your goals, we're here to help you facilitate that conversation. And one of the last things I wanted to talk about was, what do we do with accounts that were in the name of recently deceased loved ones? Whether they're credit cards or bank accounts or joint brokerage accounts or things like that. It's important for you, whether you do it with us or it's something outside, like a checking account. It's important to take those steps. And I know that in the wake of somebody passing away, you're in that whirlwind state where you're not necessarily concentrating on the logistical nature of what to do, but it's very important that you go take care of these things, because these are where the incidences of identity theft and fraud occur. It's that in between where there's nobody to stick up for that recently deceased person, and we see that a lot. Lou was actually quoted in the New York Times about safe deposit boxes a couple of months ago, and one of the biggest problems that I see, or I did see as an estate attorney, was that people would leave their wills in a safe deposit box. When the Social Security Administration tells your bank that you've passed away, the first thing they lock is the safe deposit box. Yeah. Now you can't get your will. Mm-hmm. On top of that, if somebody walks in there claiming to be the recently deceased person, I gotta tell you, the bank teller is not gonna think too hard about it. If they can show the proper documentation, they're gonna let them right in. So think about it that way. A lot of people ask us in these times, who should I contact to help me with those things? For the big investment accounts, you can contact us. We understand how to do that. You don't have to use your brain power when you're in that period of loss. Let us handle it. For the other accounts, We'll walk you through that as well. We're able to know exactly how those accounts are titled generally, and what we can do is provide you with the ability to fill out the proper forms, to take them to the proper people, to make the proper moves in order to shore up the planning post-mortem. And the final thing that I really wanted to talk about today was, what can you do to make things easier for your loved ones? This is a push that I've had for years. I've been making this push forever. It's writing a letter of intent or instruction. This is the most helpful thing you can do for your loved ones. It's not legally binding, so don't necessarily worry about having an attorney write this. But sitting down and laying out your intent for your assets is incredibly important. At the very least, if there was a will contest, and I sure hope there isn't for anybody, a judge would look to that as something that's instructive for your intentions, because at the end of the day, that's what's important. But it could also provide some color around the things that you have in your house that don't have monetary value or of only sentimental value. I can't tell you how many situations have been solved by simply looking at a letter and, you know, the recently deceased has laid out a letter that just says, I want the china from my grandmother to go here. And it's as simple as that. And then you don't have to have siblings or children fighting over it. Because most of the time, your question?
Does that have to be witnessed?
No.
No?
No, it can be a very personal thing. It can be something that you keep in a drawer locked away and you tell your family, after I pass away, check this drawer. There's a letter. That's what I want. You don't have to discuss it with these people first if that's not something you'd like to do. Oftentimes we hear people giving away certain family things before they pass away, just because they, what was the phrase? They want to do it with a warm hand. That's a new phrase that we're working.
Do you know what that means?
You're still alive.
A lot of yes. people don't know what it means right, when you're still alive, so you can give it to them and enjoy how they're using it and watching them, and like having that money to buy a house or to educate their kids. And the first time I heard it years ago, a client said it, and I thought, like, what does that mean? And now, probably once a year, somebody comes in and says, I want to give my money with a warm hand. So I've gotten used to it. And it's a good expression.
It is. It's a new one, and it's something that I think we might be using in the future. I don't know. I'll roll it out. If you hear me say it, that's what it means. But it's important. So if you want to do that, by all means, do that. It'll probably be more meaningful, certainly, if you're giving a family heirloom away or something like that. My mother actually recently just gave me this ring from my grandfather, like, a week ago.
Oh.
She said, I'm cleaning out the house, get this junk out, and take this ring. I'm just kidding, but I thought I would wear it today in light of that story. But it can be a nice thing, and she likes that I have it. Alternatively, if you don't want to give stuff away during your life because you think, I don't know, they might lose it or sell it or pawn it, that's your family and mine. A letter of intent is something that can be a really nice gesture, and it goes a long way in explaining the meaning behind things and why you want that specific person to have something. So just things to think about. And at the end of the day, the big takeaway is planning early and having the conversations often will save you money and time and headache and animosity. And if you have any questions about any of that, please feel free to come talk to me or give me a call, and I'm happy to discuss it with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, we can take questions now.
If you have to select an outside entity to be either a trustee of a trust or executor, any corporate entity that you choose, nobody would have any personal interest because the officers come and go. Is there a better choice where you don't have your own to make them trustee or executor?
Okay, that's a great question. So there's really three entities, I would say, that you can name as a corporate trust or as a trustee or executor. The first being your family members. If you have financially savvy, responsible, diligent family members, that could be a good choice. If anybody has those, let me know. I could use them. You got one? All right, we'll take care of that. The second one would be your attorney or your accountant. New York State doesn't love when attorneys serve as executors, especially if they have drafted the will. It looks a little double-dippy, if that's a term. You really want them to get paid twice, and I understand that. Accountants can be a good choice, but again, accountants aren't transactional. They don't really go to court. So that's another choice. But the last thing you mentioned, the corporate executor or corporate trustee, you're right. It's a little impersonal. They rotate through people.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, the organization is always going to be there. They are a fiduciary in the same sense that we're a fiduciary and they're supposed to be looking out for your best interest. Generally, they also have the knowledge. They know exactly how to administer an estate and how to administer a trust. And you would hope that that knowledge carries over so that it's administered correctly. But the final thing that I want you to keep in mind about a corporate executor or a corporate trustee is, even though it might be an impersonal experience, what they also have that your family members don't have are giant insurance policies. So if you have a very large estate, or you have a complicated estate, or something that you think could be, you know, a little dicey between your family members, one, they're independent, but two, if they screw up, that's who you get to sue. That's who your family members get to sue. They carry giant insurance policies because of it, and your family members won't. So if they screw up, that's what it is. So just something to think about if you think there might be an issue after you pass away and that family members might not get along. It is impersonal, but it will also be independent.
And the last question is, with all this internet stuff where you got passwords for 3,000 of your accounts, what do you do with those passwords? Prepare a list and keep someplace, I'm told, or some thief will come and he'll steal your list. Where do you keep such a list so that the survivors get it?
That's a great question. Okay, so kind of a new field in estate planning, but it is planning for your digital assets, and whether that's your Facebook or your LinkedIn or whatever you kids use, I don't know. But there's password managers. There's apps that aggregate all passwords. I know how ridiculous that sounds because it's the same thing. I'd hate to say there's no great way to keep the passwords for your social media accounts, but there's not. I recently had a client who pulled a legal-sized piece of paper out of a fanny pack and it had all of her passwords on it. I said, please don't carry that around anymore.
So where do we keep it? Because they're all hackable. Anything that's online is hackable in 2 seconds.
Yes. That's true. I don't have an answer for you. I would say if you want to keep a list of your passwords, a great place to keep it would be in the vault on your client portal. It is double military grade encrypted, and it's probably the safest place that I know. So if you don't have the client portal, get the client portal. If you do, make a list and keep it in the portal. It's pretty easy, and that'll be the easiest way to do it. If you want to write some sort of list and give it to your beneficiaries upon your death, you could do that too, but if you're like me and reset your password every day because you can't remember it, that's not really going to help you, right?
Keith, what do you do if you don't know any good attorneys or you're not sure what to do? How to stock, what do you do?
Sure. One thing you could do would be to contact your AltFest advisor. We've worked with dozens and dozens of excellent estate attorneys. We have a good idea of who knows what and who can handle complicated estates or simple estates, or whether they're in Brooklyn and you're in Manhattan. We have the ability to really help you with that and pick somebody that would match up well for you. If you don't like our suggestions, then there are plenty of other ways we can go about it. I know a couple of estate attorneys. I can help you there. If that's a concern for you, let us know. We'd be happy to help you find somebody who makes sense.
Is it true that attorneys usually won't just amend your will, like you have a new idea, and do they always want to start over?
No, attorneys are very honest people. No, you're 100% right.
They will be de-licensed if they become honest.
Yes, that's right.
I actually updated my will a little over a year ago, and there's a change I want to make, and I contacted the attorney, and she is going to, you know, it's a small change.
It's the same attorney who made
same attorney,
the will?
Oh, the so same that, attorney, that's a good but story. There will be, you know, a fee, not the same fee.
Of course. Yeah.
So a small change, they might do something that's called a codicil, which is just an addendum
document. I don't think they do that anymore. Do they?
They do. That's for a very minor change. Yeah. Most attorneys who tell you if you're going to make a substantial change, they're going to want you to rewrite your will. Mm-hmm. If your attorney tells you that, ask us first. There might be a simpler way of doing things. Let's not pay for a full estate plan if you don't have to. But if you haven't had a will updated since 2010, call us. If you haven't had a will updated since 2017, also call us. If you've had new grandchildren, call us. If you want the full list, also call us. I'll give you the full list over the phone.
Actually, I just thought of a question. I have some charities in my will, and, you know, the charities, their rating sometimes changes, or you change your mind about the charity, and the charity must be in the will, and it drives me crazy that you have to have the whole will, this isn't the change I'm making now, but you have to have the whole will redone, just because I always wish that that could be a codicil.
That can be a codicil.
Yeah?
Yes. That can absolutely be a codicil. If you're going to make a substantial change, and there's other things, then you might as well restate
right,
the will.
Right, yeah.
If it's just replacing one beneficiary, that can be a very easy change. It's normally a one-page document, so if someone's telling you it's going to be more than that, please let us know.
More than what? A day?
More than like a one-page document. That can really be accomplished quickly.
The only risk factor with the codicil business is very simple. See, they're two separate documents.
Uh-huh.
If the codicil gets lost or is not put together properly, the one that you intended not to go will still go.
Right.
Because as a result, the codicil, they do not cross out anything.
That's a good point.
On the original.
Right.
And
well, that's Lee, what I'm saying.
You remind me of, I was once speaking in the New York Public Library to about 200 people I had never seen before, meaning that I didn't know their situations, their families, their ideas. So I was talking about a will, and some people were saying, you know, I went online, I made my own, and I think that there's so many ways you could mess that up. It's really a good idea to see an attorney. And so this woman put up her hand, and I said, yes, you have a question? And she said, well, you know, I went online, I did it myself, I filled out this whole will, but I have a question for you. She said, do I have to sign it?
That was a good question.
I think you should call an attorney. So.
If you have a will, but you don't have a trust, and the only thing that's in your trust is your apartment, do you still have to go through a long probate?
Yes. It's not necessarily a long process, and in New York, we have probate fees capped at $1,200, so $1,250, so it's not necessarily too expensive either, but we can accomplish a lot of things by retitling assets to your trust. On a more case-specific basis, we should have a conversation about this, but you can save yourself a lot of time and effort and save your family a lot of time and effort if you were to do some retitling prior to passing away.
Do you have a preference between titling to a trust or to specific people, beneficiaries?
That's a great question. That's beneficiary dependent. It's important when you speak with your attorney or your advisor to kind of give them an idea of how financially savvy your beneficiary is and how responsible your beneficiary is and whether you think that person would carry out the intentions that you have for your assets.
Well, so let's say I have an IRA account. Should I leave it to my two sons directly or leave it to a trust that's in for the benefit of my two sons?
That's a little dependent on your two sons.
They're both good boys.
They're both good. Okay. If you feel comfortable leaving it to them, I mean, it's an IRA, so they're not getting it outright.
Right.
So, yeah, if they're going to continue and just receive the RMD payments, I don't see why not. But if you came back and told me my son spends every dollar he's ever seen, we might be having a different conversation.
Okay, so the trust doesn't mean anything. Other than
it could.
Other than being cautious about their spending.
I like to err on the side of cautious.
Okay.
So if you think there's any question about how that money might end up, might be worth drafting a trust. The only thing is with an IRA, there are specific rules about how the RMDs pass through. So they will end up with money of some sorts, but you can control a lot of that. That's the benefit of a trust, is that you do get a semblance of control.
Okay. It might sound like a stupid question. I know we could call you and find out the names of lawyers, but do we first meet with you first to figure out what has to go into a trust and what doesn't need to go into a trust, or do we meet with the lawyer first? I don't know. I don't understand the order of it.
Sure. It would be my preference that you come and meet with your advisor first. There's two reasons for that. If you go meet with the attorney first, you might get some suggestions that are not necessarily appropriate because that person's going to bill you for it.
Uh-huh.
The second reason is because AllFest manages your assets or a portion of your assets and has a better overall picture of your financial plan. We have the ability to make some suggestions that the attorney might not necessarily make. For instance, we had a couple who came in and they were doing some estate planning. They were each going to get a revocable trust. The husband was in his 80s and the wife was in her early 60s. And when we asked the attorney how he wanted to split the assets, he said it doesn't matter. They had very appreciated Amazon stock, which upon death receives a step up. So rather than just split it, where this woman is never going to be able to sell this stock for the rest of her life, it was titled completely in the name of the husband. And that's something that AltFest would provide you and the attorney completely overlooked. So coming to us first could save you headaches in the long run.
How about real estate, especially in the New York market with the co-ops and condos and the different bylaws and regulations of the different co-ops? about putting your real estate into a trust and how easy or not easy it is for your beneficiaries to then deal with the co-op rules.
It's very co-op dependent, I'll tell you that. It is difficult in a lot of places. They don't want trusts to own it, or, you know, own shares in a cooperative. But at the end of the day, a REF trust has no standalone legal basis. Revocable trusts file taxes in your social security number. Ownership doesn't change. You can push back on co-op boards. That's a good question for you.
Just because I'm active on my co-op board, he's giving me a funny look.
Some co-op boards have problems with it. I think others are modernizing and joining us in the 21st century, and hopefully a lot more will soon, too.
Yeah,
Explain what you just said.
Yeah, you were talking about a revocable trust.
Sure. Are you talking
now,
about
what
it?
About an irrevocable trust?
I really haven't come across a co-op board that's going to okay that yet.
What's the difference?
An irrevocable trust generally has a standalone tax ID and exists as its own legal entity, which means that when co-op shares are placed in the trust, it's now changing ownership. Co-op boards are notorious for being stingy about how ownership changes. So if there is going to be a change, or you're going to try to leave it to an irrevocable trust, there may be some pushback. I can't guarantee they'll let you. I can't guarantee they won't either, but people are getting...
You can leave it in a trust under your own social security number?
Yeah, you can. They'll definitely push back, but it doesn't mean you won't be able to accomplish that.
I will say that if you live in a co-op, I don't know so much about condos, but if you live in a New York City co-op, you'd want to ask the board or management there if they allow that, because some do and many, many don't. And the ones that do often want a guarantor. They want to know there's a person they can go to behind it and not just a trust, because then who do you go to if there's an issue? So they want a person to do that. So you better find out if that's possible at all. Then I have heard recently from my managing agent that more and more co-ops are considering it, but it's basically on a one-on-one basis. So they won't say, well, we didn't do it before, and now we're allowing trusts. We're going to do it forever for everybody who comes to us, because you'll have a flood of people, and some will be appropriate, and some won't be appropriate. So they'll just consider each one, I think.
Okay. And what's the advantage to putting it in a trust? Why would you put it in a trust and just not?
Sure. So the advantage to leaving it in a revocable trust is that the shares will avoid probate on your death,
okay.
which is nice.
Revocable trust.
Yes, revocable.
Revocable.
I'm going to do it that way. All right, so it's a revocable trust. One, it stays in your social security number. So like Karen was saying, a little easier if you're going to make a transfer in a co-op board, you'll probably find that a little more palatable. But upon your death, those shares will pass by the trust agreement as opposed to your will. So you're not going to have your executor go downtown and file your will and have the shares pass that way. The other nice thing is that when you have a revocable trust, you generally are going to name a backup trustee, so someone to step into your place if you become incapacitated. So in the case that a decision has to be made about the co-op shares and you've reached a period of incapacity, that person is already in place to step in.
Does the power of attorney accomplish that?
It does. It accomplishes that in a similar way, but it would be a standalone document. Generally, you don't file up your power of attorney with your co-op board. But if they're going to let you put the shares into trust, they're going to have the trust agreement more than likely. So they're going to have that person's name, that person's contact information right away. So if, God forbid, something happens to you, there is somebody to step into your shoes. And that also goes for bank accounts, by the way. If anybody's considering that, if you are to retitle your bank accounts in the name of your revocable trust, similarly, if there's a period of incapacity, your successor trustee can step in and perhaps write checks or go to the bank for you. A power of attorney would accomplish a similar goal, but if you plan on going to the local Chase and convincing the teller that this power of attorney is valid, you're going to have a long day.
Does a trust have to pay separate taxes?
If it's a revocable trust, all the taxation passes through to you. If it's an irrevocable trust, there's different tax circumstances.
Are you saying you can do away with probate if virtually everything you own goes into a revocable trust?
If everything you own is in a trust, you will have nothing to probate.
Okay.
But
can you put an automobile in there?
You can really put whatever you want in there, but you'd have to retitle it in the name of the trust. So
I just heard for insurance purposes and accidents and whatnot that automobiles sometimes can't be put in there.
It's very hard to title an automobile with the state of New York in a trust.
Jersey, too.
And New Jersey. I mentioned having a tough time with the bank teller. Good luck at the DMV explaining how the trust works.
In New York, what's the average length of time to go through probate?
Getting worse.
Do you live in Manhattan?
I do.
27 years. No, I'm just kidding. that's a good question. If you have a small estate, if you've done proper titling and put things in the revocable trust, if you have a very, very small estate, there is some summary probate. You can pay for a very small estate. It goes very quickly. It can be done in 3 or 4 months at most.
But if you have a trust, I thought you didn't need to go through probate.
If everything you own is in the trust, you don't need to go through probate. Everything. Everything, everything. It's very, very hard to put everything you own in a trust. That would include somehow getting your furniture titled that way. I don't know how you would do all of that stuff, but like at the end of the day, for $1,200, the will gets filed. Basically, the judge looks at it. He goes, okay, this is a great will. All the furniture goes to your kids. It's really not a big deal, and once you hire the attorney takes care of it. But investment assets, homes, those are all good things to retitle. And if those go through the trust, rather, they also stay private. Probate is a public process. So something to
what
consider.
What do you consider a small?
Yeah.
I'd have to double check what the regulations are now, but I think it's below like $50,000.
It's considered a small estate. Mm-hmm. Anything above that.
It doesn't sound like a lot, but when you take your investment accounts and your retirement accounts, you retitle them in the name of a trust, you're left with bank accounts, usually. And if your home is in the trust, like, you can do it. It can be done. And it might save you some time and headache in the long run.
Keith, thank you so much. We're going to take more questions at the end.
You got it.
And Allison's going to go over worksheets.
All right. So with everything we just heard from Keith, I think it's pretty clear we all want an estate plan that's up to date and reflective of our wishes, whether it's so we can make sure that our beneficiaries and our loved ones have an easy process when they're settling our estate, or just to make sure that, you know, everything's given to who we want it to be given to. But even though we know that we should do it, we don't always follow through with that, whether it's because we'll do it next weekend and then 5 years from now it still hasn't happened, or a large part of it, I think, is just because you have to face some uncomfortable decisions and it definitely can be overwhelming. So today, what we want to do is walk you through some of the practical considerations that you might face as you go through this process of updating, reviewing your estate plan, things like that. So you have a worksheet in your folder. It's broken up into three different sections. We have the transferring assets after I'm gone, making decisions, and my choices. So within each of these sections, we've basically listed a handful of considerations and statements for you to rank from low to high in terms of how important it is to you or how much you agree with that statement. And keep in mind that it's completely private, as Karen was saying. We're not going to take it in and grade it or anything like that. It's to take home with you. As we go through the packet, take your time, and at each section we can stop and you'll fill it out. And if you have any stories to share, please do. Starting in the first section, we want to get you thinking about how you want to transfer your assets. So do you want all of your beneficiaries to receive equal amounts? Do you want it to be based on need? Do you want it to be based on their appreciation of your things? On the one hand, if everything is split equally, it might be seen as more objective and fair, but not every situation is the same. Maybe one child is earning millions of dollars and your other child isn't in as comfortable of a situation, so you want to compensate a little bit. Or that's, you know, a hypothetical, but in real life, maybe you have a special needs child who you want to ensure is taken care of well after you're gone. That was the case for one of our clients. She gave a majority of her financial assets to her special needs child, and it put her mind at ease. But she didn't want her other child, who was more established in her career, and she wasn't as worried about her. She didn't want her to feel neglected. So ultimately what she did was give her some high-valued antiques and jewelry that she knew she would appreciate, but they still were worth something that she didn't feel as though that child wasn't receiving as much. But again, so every situation is not the same. It's completely up to you how you want it to go. As Keith was saying, maybe you want to leave some sort of letter of intent if you want to explain why you did something the way you did it. Maybe you want to have the conversation with your family as you go through. I'll give you guys a moment to fill out this particular section, and if anyone has any experiences or stories they want to share. Yeah.
What I did one time is, privacy is your biggest enemy. No parent wants to let the kids know what the hell they have. Mm-hmm. That's your biggest enemy. Knowing that the moment you are silenced, they will get it. So instead of you choosing who gets what, it's better to lay out the list, give it to them, tick mark what you want. And I got better results that way.
That's one way to do it.
Yeah.
But how about if they both want the same thing?
Then I'm the decider, but at least I know where they come from.
That's good.
At least I know where they come from.
Toss a coin.
Oh. I said that to half in jest, but my mother did that with her jewelry. She handpicked certain pieces for her, each daughter and each grandchild. And then she just said, go around by age, you know, the oldest will pick first and pick the rest. Everybody just went around and picked, you know, different pieces. But she did pick one piece for each individual person and discussed it.
Sounds very
ahead
lovely.
Of time.
Sounds yeah. nice, so, man. Yeah.
The one thing she didn't do is leave for, we have a brother for her daughter-in-law, who she was very close with, my sister-in-law. So we included her into the rotation.
That's nice.
But, you know, something to think about. Yeah. Just thinking in terms of to your daughters, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. Daughter-in-laws are important.
You know, if you like them.
What you like.
If you like them.
No, I only have daughters. But
so
my mother did love her daughter-in-law. She really did. I guess maybe she did it before my brother was married, so she didn't think to update that piece. I don't know, but I don't know.
Sometimes when it comes about that they have several children who want the same thing, that can get difficult, but we solved it in a very simple process with my mother's situation, and then we just drew lots, you know, and whoever got the shortest straw or whatever, we just did it by chance. And it worked out. Everybody was accepting of that.
Yeah.
You know, it takes it off the responsibility of the person who's making the gift.
Yeah, it's just up to chance, whatever you pull. So,
yeah,
so.
Exactly.
I just like to give a personal, sadly a very difficult situation in terms of a will, of updating a will. Friends of my sister lost their daughter. She was in her late 20s. She was married. She had been a teacher and took out all the benefits of being a teacher, and she was unmarried and left her parents as a beneficiary. So when she died, even though she was married, it had never been changed, and her parents inherited this one benefit, and it was, I don't know, maybe about $200,000. And they, in their good intentions, bought a college education fund for this grandchild that survived the daughter. And the daughter's husband was a school teacher raising this baby and could have used the money and wasn't named as a beneficiary.
Wow.
Because she was so young when she was a teacher, she never thought to change it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the parents who inherited it thought they were doing the right thing by buying this college education fund for the grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out not to be what the son-in-law needed.
Yeah. As Keith was saying, when things happen.
It was a major rift in the family.
Yeah.
They haven't been able to address through the years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious about one thing, because you keep saying discuss it with the family members. And I've been making wills for 30 years or 40 years, and situations change, and players change, and relationships change. And I'm really glad that I didn't tell people, because then it's
even worse to have to backtrack.
That's really
and so I'm always hesitant about the telling, sitting everybody down.
Yeah, and in that case, that's when that letter of intent that Keith talked about could be a good thing, that, you know, it just is there for them to read over afterwards and kind of make sense of what happened. If it wasn't just an equal distribution, you can be like, oh, that's why this one got more, and you don't have negative feelings. But that's a good point. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I have a letter of intent or an instructional letter, and I always sign and date it. Whenever I update it, I always sign and date it. I've been doing that for a long time. And I think I read somewhere recently that it's best to sign it.
I mean, I think what Keith is saying is not legally binding.
Right.
So it's more just something nice for the family to read afterwards. I'm not sure if you need to sign it or not, but it's more just should be able to be found by your family members and read. All right.
At the end of the day, no matter what you do, somebody will be pissed.
Did you have something else?
Well, just, Karen, I know you and Lou are both authors, so in my will, I also have an heir for the book rights. So
we didn't do that.
So it's something you might want to think about.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell Lou.
Yeah. Right.
Not expecting big returns.
But it's true, because it continues after.
Yeah.
The distribution.
So it's 70 years after the author's death. The term.
I don't know. All right, so if we move to the next page, we want to drill down another level and basically think about some of the decisions you might have to make when you're implementing what you thought about on the first page. So one of the big ones here, which Keith kind of touched on earlier, was giving with a warm hand or while you're alive. So do you want to witness some of the joy or gratitude of the beneficiaries when they receive a certain gift that maybe they had a need for, a down payment on a home, college education, a wedding? I think it's very rewarding to see it if you can afford to do that. But on the other hand, if you just want all of your assets to transfer, you know, upon your death, at least it's kind of considered a safer option. You know, you have all of your assets now for your own consumption, and whatever's left over will transfer. So that's something to think about. And there's certainly pluses and minuses to both, and it doesn't have to be an all or nothing type of thing. But if on the earlier page you thought you wanted everything to be equal, it could be something where you deduct the amount that you gave during your lifetime from the total that is given at the end. And Keith told me that's called an advancement. It was a legal term, I guess.
That is nice.
So go ahead and fill out this particular section. Okay, and then finally on the last page, we'll just dive one level deeper and go to your choices. So you want to figure out the who's, you know, who do you want to give to? Who do you want your executor to be? When it comes to beneficiaries, we often see the spouse or children being named, but what if you don't have close family that you want to give it to? And in those situations, we might see, you know, extended family, close friends, charitable organizations or organizations that stand for causes that you care about, religious institutions, even alumni associations. Ultimately, again, this is your choice, and it should be just where you want to see your money benefit, whether it's an organization or a person. And then in terms of... Yeah?
I just wanted to ask you about executors. Is it true that an executor outside of the family sort of automatically gets a percentage of the estate that's being handled, or does it be...
I think, can they deduct a certain, or be charged a certain amount that they can...
In New York, if you don't specify that your executor is to not take a fee for performing their duties, the standard is a reasonable compensation. If anybody could tell me what that means, you're a better attorney than I am, but the courts haven't weighed in on what's reasonable and what's not reasonable, so your best bet is to spell it out.
So what the fee would be? Mm-hmm.
You can name a fee in your will.
You can name a fee
also
if you
exclude a fee.
Yeah, you can exclude a fee. You can name a fee. If you name a fee, a corporate executor might not take it. So there's that risk. And if you exclude a fee, you might have tough time getting anybody to take it. So you kind of have to weigh it out. If you have a responsible family member that can handle a non-complicated estate, that can be an option for you, so they don't have to be compensated. But if your estate reaches the level where it's complicated enough that you think an independent trustee should handle it, then their fee would be agreed to by the beneficiaries or the court if they're so appointed.
Beforehand.
Before they accept the appointment, yes.
Mm-hmm. Who would be a corporate executive?
A bank? A bank or a trust company, generally. Most of the large banks in New York have a department that does trusteeship and executorship. Many of the smaller banks do as well, and there's some standalone companies that'll perform that role.
Because I know in California, it's terrible. My nephew's going through it now. They have a whole schedule of fees for the estate, and so much for this amount. And the higher it goes, the higher the fee. It can be quite substantial.
It can be. That's certainly
true. $25,000.
Yeah.
Depending on the value of the estate.
Yes, but those fees aren't arbitrary, and if the estate is large enough and complicated enough, paying the fees up front can save you a lot of headaches in the long run. And like I mentioned before, they also have insurance policies, so if they do mess something up, you can go after them to be made whole. So that's important to consider.
All right. So I think we've been through each of these sections, and more than anything, it's just to get you thinking, as Karen was saying, about some of these things and how you'd like your wishes to be, conversations with family, conversations with your financial advisor, conversations with your estate attorney, any stuff like that. So hopefully it was helpful and that you can go home and think about it more.
Are there any additional questions? Is anybody here? Yes.
Steps of deciding whether you need a trust. Is that something that your attorney would reflect on depending on your whole situation?
Right, it depends on your wishes.
I mean,
your financial situation, the people you're leaving things to, like your goals, your reasons. Why are you doing this? Is this appropriate to help you accomplish that goal? So, yeah, you could speak to a financial advisor, you could speak to your attorney. Either way, you'll get the help you need, but you should go in with a clear idea of what your wishes are, what you're trying to accomplish, and then they'll tell you if that's the right vehicle to help you accomplish it. And I always tell people that, you know, if they think through a lot of these things before and they go in to see an attorney and say, this is what I want, it'll save them and the attorney a lot of time, probably save you some fees in the long run. But, you know, I've had clients call up sometimes for 2 years and say, you know, I don't have children, I don't have any nieces and nephews, I don't know who to leave my money to, you know, what should I do? And if they went to an attorney and they talked for 2 years about it, they'd have 2 years of billings. So I think it's better to go in once you've made those decisions and knowing that in the future, if you're in good health and you're here, you can make a change. It doesn't have to be for, you know, some of us do our wills with the first child, so maybe you're 25. Mm-hmm. You don't have to keep that forever, maybe every 5 years or 10 years. Certainly when there are new tax laws passed, right, it's a good time to redo your will. But it's always good to go in with at least a pretty strong... I mean, the attorney may not know which of your children's responsible and which isn't, or, you know, whatever else is bothering you. So how much advice can he give you in that direction anyway? You know, you have to go to him with the information. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What about living wills and health directives and things like that?
All important. Everyone should have one.
How often do you really have to update that, though? Because I know when my father was sick, we got some problems down in Florida. It wasn't that it was so old, that, but it was that Florida had some laws at that time where the eldest child had to be the one. And my brother, who was younger, couldn't execute against the health, you know, living will. I had to fly down and do it. How do you figure out that?
Sure. I won't necessarily speculate on Florida law too much, or I won't try to, because it's a little bit different. But you should update your living will every time you update your estate plan, just like anything else, any major changes to your family. But more importantly, as medical science advances and we are seeing ways of kind of keeping people alive, for lack of a better term, you should consider that, because if you are not somebody who's wanting to be on artificial nutrition or artificial breathing, you should make that decision, make it clear, and file those documents with your primary physician. For the record, though, I'll just throw this in. If they take you to an emergency room, though, that document is useless. They will save you no matter what, or try to. So just keep that in mind.
Judy has a question.
Something I recommend is a pre-plan. I have a pre-plan, and I have an elderly father that has a pre-plan. It's you pay for your funeral expenses and any other, you know, if you have certain religious beliefs or whatever, it's pre-planned and it's prepaid for. And so your heir only has to make one phone call to the funeral home. It makes it much easier when they're in an emotional state, and something that's very heavily regulated in New York State. So this money is in a fund that earns interest, and you get a statement every year. So I think it's a very practical and good thing.
I think that's a wonderful suggestion.
Yeah.
Those funds are also protected from bankruptcy and those creditors.
But I think it's interesting what you said, because it sounds as if estate planning is a lot for you, so you're comfortable, you did what you wanted to do, you did the right thing, and some of it's for your heirs, so to give them less bother,
right.
And
exactly.
It's a combination.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so the things are carried out the way you want them,
right.
At that time,
right.
According to your wishes.
Yeah. Roberta, you had something?
And what about protection from creditors after you pass? Is there any device you can leave your money into?
Yeah, absolutely. The best thing you can do is, if you're worried about creditors for your heirs, to place everything in an irrevocable trust. IRR, irrevocable. That would be the best thing you can do. Generally, by taking away control of the assets from your heirs, they have the inability to attach them, or creditors cannot get to them. So that's the...
So the heirs can't get to it either? I don't understand.
Well, the heirs will be able to get to it. You're leaving it in a trust, and hopefully the trustee that you've chosen is given good instructions by your trust agreement as to how your beneficiaries will be able to access the funds. But since the trustee is the legal owner of the assets, your beneficiary's creditors cannot access the funds within the trust until they are distributed. And if you've written your trust well and went to a good attorney, distributions won't be mandatory. So they can be locked up in that trust for as long as that creditor wants to sit there and wait for it.
Is that typically done?
Absolutely.
Could if you say something about why sometimes you have a revocable trust and sometimes you have an irrevocable trust?
Sure.
Okay.
So a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust serve a lot of different purposes. The revocable trust during your lifetime means you can alter, amend, revoke it, and you have the ability to control the assets. Similarly, though, since you have the ability to control the assets, the creditors can get at them. So really, it's not a standalone entity. It files taxes in your Social Security number, and it's reachable by anybody that you may have aggrieved. And that includes if you get into a car accident or you beat somebody up on the subway. I don't know why you would do that, but don't do it. But they can get at your assets. An irrevocable trust is a standalone entity. It files under its own tax ID. So it's essentially like having a small corporation. You would do that in case you're in a litigious situation. If you're a physician and you think you may be sued for malpractice, if you run a business, for instance, and you think there could be somebody coming after you because of something you do with your business, you can put your assets in an irrevocable trust, and then they're untouchable by your creditors. Unless, of course, you're committing some sort of malfeasance, and don't do that either.
How about the IRA and profit sharing plans? Yeah.
Creditor protection?
Right.
Sure. So within a 401k or 403b or a qualified plan, you have an unlimited bankruptcy and creditor protection. So creditors can't get at them. If you roll them out to a non-qualified plan, in bankruptcy protection, you're protected to $1,283,000, something like that, for bankruptcy. And generally, if you've rolled over your plan and you were the one who saved that money for your retirement, it's very hard for a creditor to get at it. That being said, inherited IRAs are much easier because the money wasn't intended for you as the inherited beneficiary.
How about you transfer the IRA or profit sharing plan to the trust account?
So naming the trust as the beneficiary?
Right.
You can do that, but that requires jumping through a couple of other hoops. So you'd be required to file the trust document with the IRS by October of the year following your death, so that would be on your executor. On top of that, the trust has to include certain language and has to become either an accumulation trust or a conduit trust, and it becomes a little more complicated. For instance, if you name multiple beneficiaries and the document isn't drafted correctly, the IRS will assume that the oldest beneficiary is the age to be used for RMDs, and we'll start paying out RMDs at the oldest beneficiary. So if you accidentally kept your elderly uncle within your trust agreement and forgot to take him out because you haven't renewed your estate plan, they might be doing RMDs at 91 and you have kids who are 23 and 24.
How about your grandchildren?
If your grandchildren are the only beneficiaries, they'll use the youngest grandchild for the RMDs.
On an irrevocable trust, it sounds like you almost need a corporate trustee, because if you name one of your heirs as the trustee, it gets complicated.
Yes,
absolutely. You can't really do that on an irrevocable trust, correct?
You can. The presumption is that any beneficiary who is also a trustee does not take part in the decision to give themselves distributions. That's the presumption. I started my career as a debt collection attorney. I can tell you that I could beat that. And I'm not a very good debt collection attorney. So better ones could take care of it. But if you plan on having an irrevocable trust, say you have two children, name one sibling as the trustee for the other and vice versa. And perhaps they don't get along, but if they want their money, they'll get along.
I don't think it's so bad to hire somebody in your family or to get somebody in your family to be the executor, because if he needs help, if it's above his pay grade, you know, he'll probably call an attorney or, you know, he won't do it all on his own. When he needs help, he'll just go in that direction. So, you know, I think it could be worked out, and then you keep it in the family, but up to you, of course. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. So happy you are all here today.